WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German theologian who took part in a failed plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler. Bonhoeffer was caught and spent 2 years in prison and was executed by the Nazis just days before the war ended. Years ago, writer Denise Giardina was given a copy of Bonhoeffer's letters and papers from prison. He became an obsession, and his moral dilemmas and honesty led her to explore his life in fiction. Her two previous books, Storming Heaven and The Unquiet Earth, were set in the land where she grew up, the coal mining country of West Virginia. Her new novel is titled Saints and Villains, and though many people might see Dietrich Bonhoeffer's heroism and sacrifice as saint-like, Giardina knew from reading his letters that he was full of conflicts and doubts.
I thought Bonhoeffer was much more interesting than the image that we have of saints, as the pictures in the books with the halos around their head and that sort of thing. He was very much aware of his own failings, and actually, I think if you had said to him, you're some sort of saint, he would have been the first person to say, not only was he not a saint, but he felt that he was one of the worst sinners possible. He had done some things earlier, such as refused to do the funeral of his sister's father-in-law. His twin sister had married a Jew, and when her husband's father died, Bonhoeffer was asked to do the funeral, and he refused because he was afraid of the repercussions. And this sort of thing haunted him. He was haunted by not having helped save a lot of Jews and not speaking out because of his family's situation. And so he felt that he was a constant failure. He had failed to get the church to really respond in the way that he wanted. And he felt that it was a sin to try to kill Hitler, and yet it was something he had to do. So he was very conflicted, and I feel that every step of the way he was much more interesting and much more dimensional than this good person who's supposed to be a saint. I think goodness is very one-dimensional, actually.
He studied at Union Theological Seminary in New York. And as you write about it, and I think as others have said as well, that his time in America was an important time for him. How did that affect his faith, his theology?
Well, Bonhoeffer came out of this tradition of German theology, which is very intellectual. And he came out of a family, first of all, which wasn't particularly religious at all. And his study of theology was an intellectual discipline to him. And this is true of many German theologians. You could be a theologian in Germany and not go to church at all, for example, which seems very strange, perhaps, to Americans. And so he came to Union Seminary and first was very put off because he thought it was intellectually shallow, and he was very critical of American theology for that reason. But he began to work at a church in Harlem and began to have a direct experience with African-American spirituality, and was very moved by that. And his exposure to that and then his experiences with racism in the United States caused him to say, when he went back to Germany, that it was at that time that he actually became a Christian.
So his theology became faith.
Exactly right. His theology became very much faith-based, and also he had come to the United States thinking that theology had nothing to do with the world and with the problems of the world, and he went back feeling just the opposite. And it was that change of mind which allowed him to look at the coming of the Nazis and what Hitler was doing and say the church has to address this.
And did he speak out? Did he speak out from his pulpit against what he saw happening in Germany?
Bonhoeffer was very outspoken about what was happening in Germany, although he began to realize, first of all, he was forced to leave the university where he taught, university in Berlin, because his views were so outspoken. And he tried to get churches. He didn't actually have a pulpit, so to speak, because he tried to get church positions and was turned down because he was considered to be either too outspoken or too challenging for the churches. They were probably not a lot different than a lot of American churches in that they wanted to go to church on Sunday morning and feel good and not be forced to look at all these things that he wanted them to look at. So he actually left Germany for a while because he just couldn't find a place to speak out. He was on the radio and was trying to give a radio talk criticizing Hitler and addressing what was happening, and he was cut off in mid-sentence. I think in the early days, he was not a person who would have been arrested immediately because he didn't really have any history of political involvement. He wasn't a socialist, for example. So he wasn't arrested, but he definitely was silenced.
Well, he eventually joined up with a group of people with a plan to assassinate Adolf Hitler. Of course, this was well into the Third Reich. Was there any chance, did he think that there was any chance for them to be successful? Was this effort doomed from the start?
I don't think he believed that the effort was doomed from the start. And actually, most people are aware of the 1944 attempt to kill Hitler, where a bomb was placed under a table and went off and killed some other people, but Hitler was saved. But in fact, there were a series of attempts before that. There was even a plot which Bonhoeffer's family and others were part of at the time of Chamberlain and Hitler meeting over the Czech crisis. And the German generals were all poised to use what they hoped would be British opposition and the British threat of going to war as a chance to overthrow Hitler and arrest him and get rid of him. And when Chamberlain caved in, that sort of knocked the pegs out from under that. But that was the first of a series of efforts where they were actually trying to contact the Allies. There was a bomb put on Hitler's plane, for example, which for some reason that no one still knows, didn't go off. And so they were very close so many times, and it would be funny if it wasn't such a horrible situation. So it was sort of like a Keystone Cops kind of everything going wrong for the plot. But there were definitely many points where it could have succeeded.
Well, as you write, and as he wrote too, that Dietrich Bonhoeffer really struggled with this plan to assassinate Hitler, the question being that if you believe murder is wrong, is it ever correct then to murder someone like Hitler? How did he struggle with that question?
Well, Bonhoeffer had been a pacifist in the 1930s. He actually had thought at one point he might go study with Gandhi and with see if Gandhi's methods could be used in Germany to get rid of Hitler. But he came to realize pretty quickly that wouldn't work and that it depends really on a committed populace, and that the populace not only would not nonviolently oppose Hitler but actually liked what Hitler was doing. And so he still struggled, though, with the idea that violence was wrong, and he also had a pretty traditional belief in terms of salvation and feeling that there are things that you could do that could get you condemned to hell. And so he began to feel that it's possible that trying to kill Hitler or killing Hitler would result in the condemnation of his soul, and yet that would be a very selfish thing to be concerned about that.
He was caught, along with others trying to assassinate Adolf Hitler, in prison for 2 years and executed days before the war was over. Did he come to terms, as you said, he thought of himself as a coward. Did he come to terms with the decisions, the choices that he had made in his life and what that said about his own faith?
Well, I hope that he did. Bonhoeffer's letters from prison end before the last few months of his life, because he was moved around from one concentration camp to another. In a poem, though, he wrote toward the end of the letters, he talks about, it's a poem that's entitled "Who Am I?" And he talks about the people in prison look at him and see this brave person who's very calm and collected and not outwardly afraid, but then he knows himself how frightened he is and how he has failed. And so is he, which one of these people is he, the failure or the courageous person? And he finally says, I don't know which I am, but God, I'm yours. Hmm. And I think, to me, that's his last word in a sense, because we really don't have his final words, so to speak. So I hope that he came to some sense of that. I think that as close as you can come, I think that he did.
Our guest is writer Denise Giardina. Her new book is a historical novel about Dietrich Bonhoeffer called Saints and Villains. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with novelist Denise Giardina. Her new book, Saints and Villains, is based on the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. In writing this book, do you think differently about your own faith and the kinds of choices that you've made?
Well, when I started writing this book, I wasn't going to church or actually paying much attention to my spiritual life. In fact, I was grown sort of bitter toward religion and all that the hypocrisy that seems to represent sometimes. And I began to feel as I wrote the book that I might write myself back into faith again. And
did you?
Actually, that's what happened. I'm an Episcopalian. I began going to church again and getting very involved, and I think in a much more mature way than I had before when I was younger, and with much more of a sense of human failings, so that what I used to see as hypocrisy, I think I now see as just, this is just part of being human.
Well, let me ask you about your couple of years as an Episcopal priest. You were ordained as an Episcopal priest back in 1979 and quit a couple of years after that. What dissatisfied you about being a priest, being a minister?
Well, I was ordained as a deacon, which is technically the first step to being a priest. And I really had gotten caught up in the whole question of ordination for women. I was in the first seminary class, which would have been allowed to be legally ordained in the Episcopal Church. And there was something very exciting about that. It was like being on this mission or something, and I had felt this strong call to go to seminary, and I think I didn't really look at what actually it meant to be ordained. And I had this horrific experience of actually kneeling before the bishop for the laying on of hands at my ordination, and feeling like the scene in The Graduate where she's marrying this one guy, but she just can't do it, and she goes running down the aisle. I just felt I should stand up and shriek, no, and just run down the aisle, because it just hit me in that one moment that it was the wrong thing to do. And that's
why,
such a horrible... At that time, I didn't know why. I really didn't, because I had thought it was the right thing to do, and it took me a couple of years to figure it out. And I think it was just that I mistook my call and my gifts. I'm not a pastoral sort of person, I think, and I'm just very introspective, and I began to find that my writing was what I was meant to be doing, and that I think actually to be ordained, I know there are people like Frederick Buechner who are ordained and are writers, but not many, and I think there's actually a sort of, there's so many expectations about what ministers are like and what they should think that I found would be too restricting for a fiction writer. I need absolute freedom and no sort of self-censorship or censorship of expectations of others about what what I should be writing about, what sort of language I should be using, what subjects I should explore, and it just began to seem that it would be just an untenable sort of restriction.
Are you a lay minister now then?
I'm a technically called a lay preacher. Our diocese has a process where you become licensed to. It just means I can preach in any church in the diocese, and it's because I have some theological training that I'm able to do this, and also because I'm involved in spiritual activities in my church and so forth.
So, do you find more freedom being a lay preacher? That you can speak more from the heart as opposed to having to speak from the hierarchy?
I think so. I think there's a pressure on priests, and it may not be quite as true in the Episcopal churches and other churches, but there's a pressure to come up with answers. I think actually questions are more important than answers, and I think as a fiction writer that's especially important. I think it's one of the jobs of a fiction writer is to ask questions and then to let the characters go at it and to not really have a final answer. I mean, the characters have to sort of go at each other and explore and challenge and say things that are maybe sacrilegious, even heretical, and I actually feel that as a layperson I can do that from the pulpit too, And I don't have the pressure that a priest has to be the comforter, in a sense. I can be a stand-in for the congregation and stand in the pulpit and say, God, we have these questions. much more fulfilling to me, I think.
Let me ask you a little bit about growing up and living in West Virginia. Tell us about the town where you grew up, a place called Black Wolf.
Right. I grew up in a coal camp, which is a town that's built and owned by a coal company, and mine was a pretty small one. There were only like 10 houses and a company store, but surrounded by other coal camps. Most of them have been torn down. The house that I grew up in a little four-room house, and it was torn down like just a couple of years after we left. And we basically were forced to leave because my father's father lost his job, and the mine closed, and the company just tore the houses down then. So when I go back there, it's like going back to a war scene, in a sense. Hardly anything is standing, not only in my coal camp, but in most of the other places in the surrounding area.
Your father worked for the coal company, local coal company?
My father was a bookkeeper for the coal company, so he wasn't a miner. I did have two uncles and a grandfather who were miners, so my family was really part management and part labor, so I got sort of a taste of both. But we lived in the same housing that the miners' families did, and the families next door to us, our next-door neighbors, for example, he was killed in the mines eventually. His kids, didn't have enough to eat. This was back in the early 60s, when Kennedy and Johnson later, were pointing out many of the problems in the Appalachian coal fields and starting the war on poverty and so forth. And it was a pretty stark place to grow up. I think it was a very good place for a writer to grow up because I saw just about everything you could see. I think I saw a lot of things that children don't usually see.
And, what did you see? I'm curious.
Well, I saw a classmate of mine who'd been shot who survived, had a gun pointed at me once, it was the kind of place where nobody had locks on their doors, and also people just kind of went in and out of one another's houses, which would drive me crazy now, but as a kid, it was really fascinating. The neighbors would just kind of walk in and sit in your living room, or the kids especially, or, everybody had their windows open. You could hear people fighting and yelling, and, a neighbor on the other side of us was a pretty violent alcoholic, and it was just... there wasn't also any sense, I think we have this sense of protecting children now, protecting them from death and so forth. And in Appalachian culture, certainly, I don't think that happens. It's very much more honest about things like death. And so I just, as a child, was exposed to that. And also, there was a large black population in the county where I grew up. And so I was exposed early on to racism and all those things. I think it was just a very honest place to grow up.
For people that have never been to West Virginia, describe for us what happens when a mining company comes to a certain area. What happens literally to the land?
Well, first of all, the companies own most of the land in southern West Virginia, which is the hardcore mining area. And so you can't build a house, for example, or start a business because they own the land, and you're not allowed to be on it. Or if you do have a house on their land and they decide they want to use it for something, then you have to leave. So you can't build stable communities, you can't build an economic base, and you don't have any tax base to support good schools or recreation and so forth. So you have, where I grew up, we had no sewage, for example, in the whole county, actually. And so everybody's sewage went into the creeks. So as a child, you couldn't play in the creek because it was full of sewage. You couldn't really play other places because they were covered with mine waste, and so if you fell down, you would hurt yourself. And so there weren't like green fields and those sorts of things, and there was strip mining. And so you really, it's environmental and community devastation. You can't drink the water. You can't walk down the road, in a sense, without it being on company property. So I didn't feel a sense of freedom. I didn't really understand when I was in school, and it was during the Cold War, what the big deal was about the Russians. It sounded to me like their situation was real similar to ours, actually.
Right. Well, let me ask you about something that you wrote in The Unquiet Earth, and this is a little girl, Jackie, who says here, this is just quoting from the novel, she says, "I'm not a real writer. Real writers live in New York apartments or sit at sidewalk cafes in Paris." Was she speaking for you back then?
That's probably the most autobiographical passage I've ever written.
Really?
I did feel that. When I was a kid, I didn't know that I could write about my own place. I didn't know that there were Appalachian writers. And I do think, too, even as an adult, when I first began to write, I wrote my first novel about medieval England because I felt no publisher would be interested in something set in the West Virginia coal fields. And I felt that somehow my specific place, first of all, wouldn't be interesting to people, and also that people wouldn't see it as a universal, a place that you could write about universal questions, that it would be just sort of a regional kind of thing. So, yeah, I thought writers, I never dreamed of being a writer when I was a kid. I didn't write down stories the way most writers talk about, you know, doing when they're children. I had stories in my head all the time. I just constantly told stories to myself, but I just didn't, the idea of writing them down didn't even cross my mind until I was probably in my mid-teens, because I just didn't think that writers came from where I came from.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty.
Denise Giardina's new book is a historical novel called Saints and Villains, and it's based on the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. This is Fresh Air.